Thank you, Tommy. Good morning, church. It is good to see you and be with you on this rainy summer. It looks like it's going to be rainy out there anyway. It's certainly a little reprieve from the heavy sun that we've had the last few days. And it's good to be gathered with the family. As always, it's good to be gathered with the family. It has been a busy summer for many. I know it's been a busy summer for us. We've had vacation time and kids going to camps and on mission trips. Jonathan just got back from Huntsville trip and hear great things about that. I'm looking forward to the Jonathan Tucker's end of summer report telling us kind of all the kids have gone and done and been a part of this summer. But it gets busy. Even in the summertime, which is we generally think of as vacation time, it gets busy, and sometimes we can forget to slow down and breathe. So like last week, we're going to do that breathing exercise, okay? We're going to start off, and this is in case you forget. We're going to do that breathing exercise. I just want you to put your feet on the floor, rest your hands on your legs if you can. This is not an invitation to go to sleep. Just up front, get that out of the way. But I want you to slow down. Take a deep breath. Slowly exhale. I hear you over there. Just keep that breathing going. Just slow inhale, slow exhale. You know, we're supposed to breathe right down in this area. But most of us, most of all of us, breathe up in here in our chests. Doctors tell us that we get 80 to 90% of our energy from breathing, not from eating or drinking, but from breathing. If that doesn't sound true to you, just don't breathe for a little while and see how energetic you feel. Right? That's supposed to be our primary source of energy, but most of us are only getting 10 to 20% of that because we're breathing up here. We're not getting all of the benefit we could be getting. You ever feel really stressed out and you get that real tight feeling in your chest where maybe it's hard to catch your breath? No. You're dismissed. Well, studies have shown that while we should be breathing around 6 times per minute, 6 times per minute is about how many breaths we need. And most Americans are breathing 18 to 20 times per minute. Isn't that crazy? It's even true of our kids, by the way. This is not just adults who grow up and get stressed out. Research has shown with like third world African children that they are breathing about 6 times a minute, which is where we're supposed to be. American kids breathe 16, 17, 18 times per minute. Now we say things like, you got to keep going, right? You can't just stand there and let the world pass you by. And so we get busy and we're thinking about the next thing and we just, that our breath gets shallower and shallower. We're thinking about all that we have to do or all that's happened to us, or we're all caught up in that, and we just don't slow down and breathe. But you ever wonder if maybe the world is not passing us by? Maybe what if in our rapid hurry that we are passing the world by? Like as we speed up, as we keep going and going and going and going, maybe our pace is outpacing what the real world is, or at least the real world that we've been called to is. During this success crazy 1980s, a new term found its way into the medical vocabulary. It was called chronic fatigue syndrome. Now, this disease has been cynically referred to as the yuppie plague. You may remember from the 1980s, that the up-and-comers, the movers and the shakers, those who were working hard at corporate jobs and trying to achieve a certain success level were referred to as yuppies. And so this came to be called the yuppie plague because it was brought on by stress, overwork and an erratic diet. Those were the kind of the contributing factors to, all of which we associate with the upwardly mobile, people who work really hard at stressful jobs and don't even have time to eat a proper meal. That's the goers, right? An estimated 4 million Americans suffer with that disease, which is not surprising because we work harder and are moving faster than ever before. Like in the history of the planet, we are moving faster, trying to do more than anyone ever. We're trying to get more and more done. Even before those of us who have never been diagnosed with CFS, but we still know what it's like to experience what we would call burnout, right? Where you go and go and go and then you just crash. Right? We know what that feels like, and suddenly the simplest tasks become monumental. I cannot load the dishwasher today. Right? That's not a hard thing. It just takes a couple of minutes and you're like, I just can't do it. I cannot fold this laundry today. I do not feel like going and paying this bill today. I mean, just like simple, ordinary things. And the day seems to drag on forever, and problems get blown way out of proportion, and you don't end up sleeping right. It just kind of piles on and piles on and piles on. Have you ever been so, this is just me. Have you ever been so busy or hectic that you do something completely idiotic? Like you lock your keys in your car with it running? I haven't done that one. But I know people who have. I've locked my keys in my car plenty of times. My friends in high school used to make fun of me because I was really good at popping my own lock. Maybe you do something like you put something in the oven, but then you forget to turn the oven on. You go back to check on it. And you're like, oh, I completely forgot to turn the oven on. Or maybe you're like, I just got to run to the store real quick and I got to grab these few things. And then you get to the store and you're like, oh, I forgot my wallet, which is pretty important when you're trying to buy things, right? You do something that's just like completely nonsensical because you're just going so fast, trying to get so much done. And these are all like minor problems overall. Like these are not big bumps in the road. But I submit to you that it poses a really big barrier to our spiritual development. Now, what we're going to talk about this morning is not just the plague of busyness. We've talked about that before. I'm not going to encourage you. This is morning, my job, what we're trying to accomplish here, is not to tell you to do less. Okay? I'm not going to tell you to work fewer hours at your job or anything like that. What I want us to look at is intentionally stopping for a short time. Like, this is not a walk off and do nothing. This is a walk off to God. Okay? We're talking about going to God for rest because God is our maker, He is our sustainer of life, and He knows that we need rest. He knows that you need rest. And He's known it for some time. All the way back in the book of Exodus, we read God's instructions telling His people to take time to slow down. Like they were working 6-day weeks, right? He said, I want you to slow down, think, and reflect, and just be. On one of your days of the week, I want you to just be. And He specifically called them to this one day of the week, and He called it Sabbath. Exodus 31:15 says, for 6 days work is to be done, but the seventh day is a day of Sabbath rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day is to be put to death. Wow. Sounds a little harsh, doesn't it? I mean, if you work on the Sabbath, you'll be put to death? In our society, we don't even sentence all of our murderers or people who commit horrific crimes, the worst of the worst, we don't even sentence all of them to death. And God is saying, if you work on the Sabbath, you ought to be killed, right? And so that's exactly what they did. And I remember this story very vividly. It's one of my most hated Bible stories from the time I was growing up. It stuck with me, not because I liked the story, but because I hated the story. It sounded just wrong. It sounded unjust. It's recorded in Numbers chapter 15. It takes place. Israel's still wandering around in the wilderness. They've left Egypt, haven't gotten to the promised land. They're in that 40-year wandering period around the wilderness. And this one man, we're never told his name or anything like that, but he goes out on the Sabbath day to gather wood. I mean, just pick up sticks. And when the people see him doing this, they like mob and they drag him before Moses and Aaron because we don't know what to do about it. What do? We take him to Moses and Aaron. And apparently Moses knows this law, right? But he's a little reluctant. He doesn't just enforce it right off because maybe he thinks it sounds harsh. I don't know. But then God speaks directly to Moses, and this is what he says. This man is to be put to death, must be put to death. The whole community must stone him outside the camp. This guy who just gathered sticks on the Sabbath day, kill him. I hate that story. It sounds like such an overcorrective, like the parent who flips out and says, you didn't pick up your broom, you're grounded for a year. Right? That's like an unrealistic sentence for such a small thing, right? And as a kid, I remember, and as an adult, even still now, this story strikes me as just completely bizarre. Put to death for gathering wood. Why did God consider the Sabbath day so important that it warranted putting some guy to death for it? And so for years, I believed that is because God was showing how important this Sabbath day was to him. And so it was important to him that we keep the Sabbath. And that's the way I always thought about it, but I wasn't the only one. The Jews who were practicing this law, that's what they thought. That most of them believed, you can't gather wood or do any work, and they came up with all these laws about things you could and could not do on the Sabbath day, because it was so important to God. So like if you sprained your ankle, you could not pour cold water over it because that would be work. You could go sit down in a brook and let the brook run over your foot because then the brook is doing the work, right? You could walk a certain distance, but you could walk no further on the Sabbath. I remember we visited a church. I was on a trip when I was in college, and we stopped at this synagogue, and it happened to be on a Sabbath day. And so we get there, and we meet the rabbi, and he's standing outside. And so we get there, and we're waiting for him to, like, let us in, but he cannot open the door. We had to open the door, and he could not turn on the lights. We had to turn on the lights because he couldn't do any of that work, right? And so Jews, for so long, they came up with all these rules because it was so important to God that we not make this day unholy. But in the New Testament, Jesus makes this interesting statement that sort of blows all of that out of the water, that contradicts this rationale. He says that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. This Sabbath day, it's for you. I didn't make you so that you would do the Sabbath, right? I made the Sabbath for you. And so we kind of put all that together. We find out that the Sabbath, this day of rest, was for our benefit. In fact, it was so important. God thought it was so important for us that if we didn't observe the Sabbath, that we as people would suffer. That's what he was saying. If you don't take this time of rest with me, you are going to suffer. You know, it's like all the other commandments, right? God didn't say don't murder because it hurts him if we murder. God said don't murder because it hurts us if we murder, right? God didn't say don't steal because it jeopardized his safety. It's because it jeopardized our safety. He didn't tell us to observe the Sabbath for his rest. It's because we need that rest, right? We need that time down, that time out. Now, obviously, as we've already noted, busyness can be detrimental to our physical health. Not just like doing a lot, but doing a lot and not stopping doing a lot, okay? We get stressed out, we get frazzled and frayed around the edges. It hurts our families, it hurts our relationships, hurts our jobs. It hurts all sorts of things in our lives. Hurts our productivity, right? If you got keep doing stuff and you don't stop, quit doing all that stuff, you start getting diminishing returns. We see people who live like at this at breakneck speed, and when they crash, which inevitably happens, we call it burnout. We call it burnout. And there's this other story in the Old Testament about a guy who experienced this kind of burnout. And he made a pretty important discovery. His name was Elijah. You may have heard of him. Pretty important guy. One of the really important prophets throughout the Old Testament. And the main story that we probably remember about Elijah is his showdown on the mountain with the prophets of Baal. It was Elijah against 450 prophets of Baal. And they were like, we're going to see which God is the real God. Yahweh God of the Israel or Baal, the God of the Canaanites. We're going to see which one is the real God. Who's really in charge here? So they each built an altar, Elijah and these 450 prophets. And then Elijah said, all right, you guys go first. There's 450 of you. Go, go, go. And you're going to pray for God to set this sacrifice, this bull you put up here. You're going to pray for your God to like set that on fire. And so they get out and they do all sorts of things. They pray and they cry out and they cut themselves. And Elijah makes fun of them. He's like, maybe your God can't hear you because he's in the bathroom. You got to go louder. I mean, that's literally in the Bible. It's so awesome. And so nothing happens. Finally, they give up. Elijah goes over to his altar, pours buckets and buckets of water all over the altar, sits down, prays really quickly, and fire comes down and consumes everything, like absolutely everything. It destroys not only the bull that's on there, it burns up all that water, it's gone. All the rocks, like, you think about how hot it's got to be to burn rocks. And some of you, you know, nerds out there probably know what temperature that is. I have no idea. But it gets really, really hot. It burns up all the rocks, and it burns up the 450 prophets of Baal and their families. Like, this fire comes in and consumes everything. And it's like, and Elijah proclaims, I told you so. It didn't say exactly those words, but it's something like that. The God of Israel is the real God. And then he prays for rain. And it starts to rain. Now, it hasn't rained in 3 years. Elijah was so upset. God was so upset that God caused it not to rain for 3 whole years. Now, imagine how dry and dusty and everything would be after 3 years of no rain, especially in a region like that. But immediately after that, the thunderstorm comes up as a little cloud, gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Then you got a deluge, just downpour. You talk about powerful, right? That is a testimony, and Elijah was right there. You would think that Elijah would just be on this huge mountaintop. You know, Elijah's been, he's been proven right, for one, against all these other prophets. But more than that, his God has worked through him in this really powerful way. And the king at that time, King Ahab, terrible king, is married to Queen Jezebel, even worse queen. I don't know, they're maybe pretty equally bad. He tells Jezebel, who is this huge follower of Baal, he says, oh, Elijah won and all your prophets are dead. And she is so furious at all this that she says, may the gods strike me and even kill me if by this time tomorrow I have not killed you. Talking about Elijah. She's like, if I hadn't killed that guy by this time tomorrow, strike me dead. It's as good as done, right? She was serious business about this. And so Elijah's response, Elijah's just faced down 450 prophets of Baal, just prayed and had fire come down from heaven in this powerful way, prayed and a 3-year drought has been broken with a powerful thunderstorm. This Elijah's like, I'm out. And he takes off. He runs away. And he runs and he runs and he runs and he finally gets to this broom tree. Now, a broom tree is not a big tree. We might call it a bush. But it offers one of the only spots of shade available in that part of the world. Elijah gets to this broom tree and he collapses beneath it, just exhausted. And this is what he says. He says, I've had enough, Lord. He said, take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. I'm as good as dead, in other words. Have you ever felt that way? Have you ever thrown up your hands to God and just said, look, I've had enough, Lord? I have. And maybe many of you, if you're being honest with yourself, you could probably say the same thing. Like you've reached some breaking point. It may have been from stressful events or bad stuff happening, or you're overworked, or you're chronically sick, or you're dealing with pain, or you've got this relationship situation that has just been going on for months or maybe even years, and it's just wearing you out, and you're like, I give up. I don't know what to do. I cannot do this anymore. We all experience this sort of burnout as Elijah. And what's our solution? What do we do? What advice do we give to others? You come to me and you tell me that, and I tell you, don't give up. You can do this. Just keep going, right? I tell you, God's not going to put more on you than you can bear. I give you a Philippians 4:13 bumper sticker. You can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. Right? That's our solution. Just keep going. You can do it. Don't give up. But interestingly, that is not what God tells Elijah. When God confronts a man who's experiencing burnout, what he does is he sends him food and water. He sends down an angel to feed him and take care of him and spend the night. And then he sends him on this 40-day sabbatical. He's like, you're going on a journey. And he travels, and he travels to this cave on the mountain of the Lord. And he gets there. He gets to spend a good night's rest, just bed down for the night. And then God asks him, what are you doing here, Elijah? Now, Elijah could have been really smart aleck. He's like, this is where you told me to go. What do you mean am I doing here? Right? He says, of course I'm here. This is where you sent me. But Elijah doesn't do that. He understands this is a deeper question than what am I physically doing in this place. You know, your friend comes to you, they're collapsing from burnout, and you say, what are you doing? You know, what's your goal here? What's going on? And so God asks Elijah, what are you doing here, Elijah? And then he listens as Elijah vents. And Elijah vents now. He gets everything off his chest. He talks about why he's so down, what's got him overwhelmed, about how alone he feels under all of that pressure. And you ever notice that, like, when you're under all that pressure, you feel really alone? Nobody can do anything to make this better. I've got to do something to make this better. You ever notice that? Either nobody can or nobody will. Certainly nobody's doing what they ought to do to make my situation better. And so Elijah feels really alone. He is literally running for his life, and all of his, for all that he's done for all of his friends, for all he's done for all his family, for all he's done for his entire community of Israelites, he feels like nobody cares. I have got all this weight on me and nobody cares. Our country is going down the toilet and nobody cares. My friends and my family have turned to this false god and it's killing them and nobody cares. And so he vents, and when he's finally done venting, he's spent his fear and his fury. That's when God comes to Elijah. He says, come on out here to the mountainside and join me out here. And which old God walks by, and when he does, there's this enormous windstorm, like so powerful, a windstorm that shakes the mountain. And then after the windstorm, there's this huge earthquake. And after the earthquake, there comes this raging fire. I mean, like, these are all massive, earth-shattering events, right? But the text says that God wasn't in any of those things. Like, wasn't in the force and the fury and the fire. That was not where God was. And then comes this still, small voice. The text calls it a whisper. And in that gentle whisper, that was where Elijah heard God. That was the voice of the Lord. It's curious, isn't it? Elijah had experienced, like, you just think about his last few months here. he had experienced the mighty displays of God. I mean, it would change your life seeing this stuff. If you went out today and prayed to the Lord to rain down fire and he burned up whatever it is you were praying over, that's a life-changing event, I would think. Right? Elijah prayed to God and it didn't rain for 3 years. Elijah challenged 450 prophets of Baal and God responded with a ball of fire that overwhelmed everyone. He prayed again and this thunderstorm started. But in the midst of going and doing and rushing, doing all this awesome stuff, he'd forgotten how to simply rest in the Lord and listen to his still small voice. Don't just stand there, do something. That's what we say. But God says, don't just do something, stand there. Be still and know that I am God, wrote the psalmist. In our minds, the most important thing we can do is like the next thing. The most important thing we can do is this next thing or something or anything. The worst thing we can do is nothing. And yet, God is far more interested in us just being present with him. What we do, what you and I do, even if it's good stuff, even if it's for God, is far less important than who we are with God. I mean, God chooses to work through us. He does. But God doesn't need your arm power or your brain power or your organizational abilities. God doesn't need any of that. God doesn't need your checkbook. God doesn't need your house or your relationships. God doesn't need those things because he's self-sufficient in and of himself. And yet he chooses you, chooses to work with us and through us for us. He wants you. That's the whole goal. He wants you. His desire for us is that we will just be with him. To be still enough to listen to his whispering, still enough to slow down and breathe. And if we're too busy to do that, we may just be too busy. Now, we have a lot of great ministries here. And this is not my sermon to tell you to drop them. Make clear on that. You have great families and people around you. And this is not the sermon me telling you to let them take care of themselves. You have friends and neighbors in need. This is not the sermon telling you to leave them to their own devices. This is the sermon to tell you that periodically, as you're doing all of those great things and your job and your community, as you're doing all of that, you need to take a time out and just be with God at a pace that's slow enough to listen to his whisper. You need to take a Sabbath rest. You can do it on Saturday or you can do it on Sunday. I don't get caught up on exactly how that works out. But you need to spend time with God to recharge so that you can keep going. Otherwise, you're just spinning your wheels, doing lots and getting nowhere. My encouragement for you this morning is to take a time out. Spend time with the Lord. Without a million things going on in your world and in your head, so that you can be who God called you to be. And if we can encourage you in that direction, if we can pray over you, lift you up for strength, give you that time out, let you know we're with you 100% in this. If you need encouragement or strength or for forgiveness, or if you're ready to live with a God who cares enough about you to give you the life you need, we want you to know that you can become a Christian today, have your sins washed away, and begin a new life. If we can help you in any way, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?